Our second speaker, Dr. Janet Kahn, is an appointee to President Obama's advisory board on prevention, health promotion, public health, and integrative medicine, and it is an honor to welcome her today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's actually an honor to be here. I'm going to have to take a minute to see if I can get all my little gizmos here. I think I'm going to put away the clock and trust you to flag me at 15 so that I can figure out. We'll be lucky if I hold it to 20 anyway. So, thank you, really. It is an honor to be here, and great job. That was really a good talk. In fact, I have this whole paper I was going to present, but I want to say a few things in response to Adam's talk first. One is to really echo what he said about how absolutely lucky we are to have Josie Briggs. I've spent 7.5 years of my life on the NCAM Advisory Council under, I just counted, 5 different directors or acting directors. If we count you, that would be 6.
Wow.
And really, it's never been so well run. There has never been a director and a staff who understands and seeks to understand really what the potential of integrative health care and CAM, all the CAM modalities are, I don't think as deeply as Josie and the staff now do. I think I find her unafraid to ask the tough questions and head into the kind of gnarliness that is in this field, and I feel like there was a certain dodging of that before this is being recorded. Okay, so I wanted to say that, and I also wanted to say on the issue of how much we pay for CAM therapies out of pocket, it is impressive, but the other thing that I always take away from that is that just puts us right in the corner of, you know, health inequities in America. So who isn't getting it, and what would the numbers be if it were actually available, affordable, covered? So we really don't have as clear an idea of what the popularity or the usage would be without that information. Okay, and I want to say one other thing in response to Adam's talk, and that is he's absolutely right about the importance of the military, both VA, where it sometimes is hard to get CAM folks credentialed, so it's a little slower than what's happening with the DOD, but these guys are really leading the way, because one of the things about the Department of Defense is that it is really a pragmatic organization. It has a very clear mission and has a very clear workforce that it knows it has to keep in good shape in order to meet its mission, and that pragmatism makes it open to things that you might not expect of them. Okay, that's it. Now I'll give my talk. So I wanted to just bring Donna in, which you've already done, so thank you so much for doing it. And I don't really have a lot to add by way of personal stories, but I will tell you that the deep color of the background, which I hope doesn't make it really hard for you to read the slides, is partly for me an acknowledgement of Donna and sort of the passion and that she brought to this field and the lush, flowy things in which she used to envelop herself often, her own style. So I just thought it would bring that here, and I hope we can move it forward. She was, as both Beth and Adam have said, really an incredibly passionate person about this field and a pioneer in this field and an incredible connector. I mean, she always wanted everybody to understand the other person's point of view also and what the meeting of these things could be. So I am indebted to her. She was a member of the board of directors of Integrated Healthcare Policy Consortium when I was the executive director. So I know how determined and repetitive on certain issues that are important to her she could be. And that's how you get things done, actually. So bless you, Donna. Okay, so I'm here to talk to you about the Affordable Care Act, which I believe that, imperfect as it is, like all laws are, but this one matters to me and probably to you a little more than many, it is nonetheless, to an unprecedented degree, really, an opportunity or offers some opportunities for complementary and integrative health care providers. So I'm putting CIHC. I'm waiting for the day when we come to agreement on language in this thing, but meanwhile, I'll say that because... Yeah, chic, I say chic. I don't know, but so don't get me started on that. Anytime you have HC around, people always sound like they're, you know, having trouble. So I just say complementary integrative health care. But even beyond the particular toeholds in the law that I think give us some opportunities to move forward with, which I will speak about later in the talk, I think that there are elements of this law that really reflect the values of complementary and integrative health care. I mean, just for instance, the focus on prevention, the focus on patient-centered care. And so I think we should, you know, just like acknowledge the victory. We shouldn't go home, we're not done, but we should acknowledge that things that we care about and things that are of benefit to our patients are in this law. And then the question is, how can we move forward with them? So I also want to say about laws, this one was only 1,000 pages, so everything couldn't be written. So you might think, you know, a 986-page law would have covered what was supposed to happen once it was passed, but in fact it's vague, like many laws are. And so this period of rulemaking or implementation, which began, you know, in 2011 or late 2010, and goes at least through 2014 with the exchanges and some other things I'll mention, is a very important time to be involved and stay involved. It's not too late. It would have been great if we'd been organized before, but it's not too late for us to continue to get organized. I mean, I gotta go through things as we go. So I want to talk for a bit about the kind of public health reframe that I think is made manifest in this law through the National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council, also the Prevention Public Health Fund that goes with it, and the advisory group, and the community transformation grants that they're making available. So I want to talk about that and then move on to other elements of the law that I think matter. So I want to say, I put these names up here because I want you to look at them for a moment, and because it's important for us to acknowledge that they make it, their fullness makes a statement. And it makes a statement that these things, prevention, health promotion, integrative public health, integrative care, public health, that these are all related to one another, but they're not exactly the same thing. There are distinctions. The distinctions were worth mentioning here. And that we should pay attention to them. And I also put them up here because the other thing that it says by giving the council the first name and the advisory group the second name and the fund the third name, is that these two bodies, the council and the advisory group, they're responsible for that whole terrain. Okay. So that's mostly what I wanted to say. The other thing to notice about these names is that they're just impossible. I mean, you can't say them all. And so in a working context, what we have is that it quickly became the National Prevention Council, and what they issued was a National Prevention Strategy, even though they were supposed to issue a National Prevention, Health Promotion, Integrative, and Public Health Strategy. Actually, in the strategy part of the law, even integrative was there. So there is a danger in letting the language go to that easy to say, rolls right off your tongue, National Prevention Council. And so some of us who are on the advisory group are fighting it all the time, just trying to stick the other words back in there, and acknowledge that there's a real difference between prevention and health promotion. When you're talking about prevention, you're trying to prevent something specific, like an illness, a disease, or a disaster, or an injury. And you don't have to have any concept of health other than the absence of those things in order to proceed in that way. In fact, you don't even have to think about health. You just have to think about preventing something icky. And but if you're about health promotion, you do have to have a vision of what health is. You do have to have a definition of what health is. So anyway, that's it. You've gotten what they hear from me all the time on the advisory group. I'm sure I'm speaking to the choir. All right, so here we are, back to the good news. There are 17 different agencies, cabinet-level agencies, departments, offices that are part of that National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council, which we will just call the Council from now on. And it's worth looking at them and seeing sort of the breadth of what is here. This is the embodiment of this administration's grasp of the concept of health in all policies, that absolutely every aspect of domestic policy has implications for the health of the nation, that it's all going to go better if we acknowledge that and move purposefully with that realization rather than just accidentally doing something that's either good or bad for people's health, if we could think about it beforehand, and if we can coordinate it and literally have the right hand knowing what the left hand is doing, or actually, you know, have the Federal Trade Commission, which might seem like an odd thing to have in here, actually understand what, you know, lead in toys that come from such and such a country or even this country do to kids' health. That would be important and good, and they should be talking to one another. That is what, I mean, that's the good news about what the administration understands, I would say. Okay. Is this what I'm doing? Okay, so the creation of the Council, the Advisory Board, the Fund, it also indicates this administration's desire to really make a dramatic shift from sickness care to a focus on health and wellness, to search for structural and infrastructural rather than simply biomedical solutions to the health problems of the nation. It is their understanding that people are really not predominantly dying of the bubonic plague anymore or any of its relatives, but in fact from our individual and collective bad habits, either uninformed or out of control choices that we make all the time, pass the chocolate. So they get it on a deep level. And I say that because we're in an odd position. Let me just, this is not on these slides, but let me just say to the side, you know, when we were trying to get these elements into the law, we had some real champions on the Hill. There are people, Senator Harkin, Senator Sanders, Senator Mikulski, we just lost one in our inspector. It's a nonpartisan issue, and there were strong champions on the Hill who understand these issues, honestly, every bit as well as any of us in this room, and they understand how to get them into policy probably better than anybody in this room, certainly better than I do. But it's hard to find, now that we're in the implementation phase, we don't have those kinds of champions for two reasons. One is they might not have been thinking about it as long. They may not really care quite as passionately about it. But the other thing is the people who implement the law are largely within the DHHS and other agency bureaucracy, and it's not their position to be passionate. It's not within their job description. So they can't say, even some of the people who are passionate and in important positions, you only get a side phone call from them or something. So we can't, anyway. So we have to do it. I think that's what I'm saying. And so that's the talk. We have to do it. Okay. So the other thing that we have in the council and in this law in general is the acknowledgement that there should really be a different kind of seamlessness between clinical care and community and environmental care, between public health and health care delivery. Okay. So they issued a national prevention strategy. It's worth reading. And also, I put this slide up really just to call our attention to the part, to the fact that it did involve a lot of input from various elements of the public, from stakeholder groups, but truly anybody could have responded to the call for public input on the draft of this document. And I say that not to say, and if you didn't do it, you missed it, but to say there are going to be repeats. This prevention strategy is going to be evaluated and updated regularly, and it's worth going in and saying to them what is and isn't there. Okay. So in the in the National Prevention Strategy, I choke on it still, it covers a lot of territory. And so what they've given us is, in this level of the circle, what they've given us is four key elements that they refer to as the strategic directions of the National Prevention Strategy. And they are healthy and safe community environments, clinical and community preventive services working together, the elimination of health disparities, and empowered people. I am here to say that both in the prevention strategy and in the action plan, which accompanies it, I mean, which came late, but the action plan is those 17 agencies each making commitments for what they are going to do in the next couple of years in order to move forward on the goals of the strategy. And so there are 200-plus specific things in the action plan. I will say that both in the strategy and the action plan, empowered people gets, from my perspective, short shrift. It literally has fewer mentions, and I would also say there's a depth of understanding of how you empower people to take responsibility for their own health that I think is missing in these documents. and or isn't that strong in these documents. And I think that the people in this room and that the people in complementary and integrative healthcare in general and providers in general probably know a lot more about how you motivate people. In fact, you spoke to it some. So I think that this is territory in which we can offer advice and we shouldn't hold back. I think that's what I'm going to say. So the next, all of these four strategic directions, they are aimed at what you see in the absolute center, which is the goal of having a strategy for a nation, and that is to increase the number of Americans who are healthy at every stage of life. And then what you see in the circle around is their top seven priorities. They probably all wouldn't be exactly my top seven priorities, but they are all factors that have a lot to do with the kinds of chronic illnesses that we are suffering and dying from and the kinds of chronic pain that people experience, and they are, in theory, controllable elements in the picture, or influenceable, let's say that, elements in the picture. Okay, so there's the action plan. And it really does just what I said before. It outlines what they're going to do. One of the interesting things is that one of the things that most of these agencies are going to do first is focus on their own workforce and look at how to engender greater well-being, health and well-being with that workforce. That's actually, you know, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, that's kind of limited. What about everybody else in the country, you know? And then I thought, well, you'll learn some stuff there and you'll get some buy-in there. So I think it's not such a bad strategy, and it also isn't the whole picture. Okay. So I'm happy to talk more about the strategy and the action plan later if you want, but let's move us forward. All right. I already said I think empowered people get short shrift. And... okay, this slide is the part where my going with the Donna Feely honoring colors really doesn't work for this slide, but all I can say to you is if you get the handout and it's in black and white, it works better. All right, I think that's the whole thing. Yeah, that was the whole thing. All right, nope, I gotta go back. Okay, so this slide is simply an attempt to sort of show the whole picture and illustrate the intersections of the key players in achieving an increasingly healthy population. And it requires, as we can see over there in primary care, you know, modernization of our healthcare delivery system with an emphasis on primary care. And people are trying to understand how to move from a system that's so incentivizes specialization into high-paying and high-tech aspects of care into how to get people to how we can really prioritize primary care. It includes public health efforts at every level, including increased coordination with healthcare providers, and here including complementary and integrated healthcare providers. There is, I want to say, a conversation that's really waiting to happen between CAM folks, for lack of a better term, CAM folks and public health folks. And it is a conversation that Donna was busy making happen all the time. And it's a conversation that can be initiated from either end. So I think I'm making the assumption that there are a lot of complementary integrative people in the room, but maybe that's not true. How many here are like primarily public health people and not complementary integrative health people? Great. Bless your hearts. And how many people here are complementary integrative health people who actually have a practice and like that? So talk about yourselves. I want to say.
How many are both?
Oh, yeah. How many are both?
Look at that.
Yeah. Right. So I find in the conversations that I initiate that I'm not getting rebuffed, that there's a lot of interest. You know, I sit on this, it's not up there anymore. I sit on this advisory board full of people who are public health officers. And, you know, I'm not that. I'm like a massage therapist. and a medical sociologist, but not a public health person. So, there's not necessarily a lot of pushback. There is either ignorance or interest or whatever, but it will take talking to one another to figure out, like, what's a first step. Like, as a massage therapist, I always think, like, God, we see everybody's skin, like, all their skin, and we see it in daylight, and most of their lovers don't even see as much of it in the light as we see. I mean, we know what's happening. Why aren't we being engaged, particularly in the state of Vermont that I live in, which has a disproportionately high level of skin cancer? Why aren't we being engaged to identify it, and why aren't we being provided with the appropriate channels for referral once we do that, instead of just saying, you know, you might want to ask your doc about that thing on your back? So there are probably 5 million of those little things that could happen and could actually make a difference. So I just encourage you to study the black and white version of this picture and start the conversations, because who knows where they'll go. They could go a really good place for your patients or for your community. Okay. So before I move on to the other aspects, I have no idea where we are on time, but before we move on to other aspects of the Affordable Care Act, I just wanted to point out how important it is that the Prevention and Public Health Fund was included in the law. And you'll see later that virtually every, I mean, that aspects of the law that have real potential, if they weren't given some appropriation in the law, they didn't necessarily get it from Congress after passage of the law when they were in their sulky phase. So what we have in the Prevention and Public Health Fund now is, as we see, $12.5 billion over a 10-year period. And this is money being made available through the community transformation grants, through other mechanisms. It's administered largely, if not entirely, probably entirely through CDCP, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, it's now called. I mean, for a while, but not that many people say so. So I thought I would. Anyway, so your state is being touched by the community transformation grants. They also, after they had done the first round, they issued another call for proposals that were for smaller entities. Like, I live in a town of Burlington. It's got 47,000 people in the town, you know, but it's the biggest city in Vermont. And even down to that level, that sort of entity could apply. So keep your eyes and ears open. There might be opportunities. It's important for us to do it. And so just a word about the advisory group. All advisory groups, like the council that Adam and I have sat on at NCAM, and like this advisory group that I sit on, you know, the key word is really advisory, meaning they don't have to do anything that you say, but you can say stuff. So you can offer your advice. So, and that's our job. It's to offer advice to the council. So my assumption is that most of the people on those 17 agencies, particularly the heads of those 17 agencies, have not spent the last 20 years thinking about integrative health care and what it could possibly offer America. But I have. So, and other people at the grassroots level have been. So it was very smart to actually give a grassroots advisory board to the council, I think. So our job is to advise them. Our job is particularly, it says in the law, to advise them on lifestyle issues related to health and to chronic illness issues. And to hold them accountable, you know, to keep coming back and saying, so about the part where, you know, it says health promotion even in your name, like that. So the advisory group has now developed four working committees or working groups. That's how we are trying to do our work. And I think that you will see in another, assuming the election goes well, I'll just say that, you will see in the next 6 months or so a flurry of activity, because we've all been on hold during the, you know, election season. And if the election does not go well, you will see this advisory group probably disappear, but there will all the many other elements of the law will still be in place. Anyway, that said, you'll hear more from those working groups in a little while, I hope and trust. So, punchline on the National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council and its advisory group and its fund is that it's not all that we wanted, it's not all that some of us asked for, when the law was being constructed, but it is more than a good step in the right direction. I think it does really express an understanding on the part of the administration about what's needed. The administration, like all the rest of us, but even more than the rest of us, has to work within what's possible. We've certainly seen that over the last couple of years. But it is, anyway, it's a good step. And I want to say that this aspect of the law has been under assault from the very beginning, particularly through the people trying to disable or misuse the prevention and public health fund. You know, so they start to refer to it as the slush fund or Obama's slush fund and suggest that every other thing that this administration has asked for they could have if they let us take the money out of the prevention fund for it. How prevention got a bad name, I don't understand, or I don't want to go there. Well, I just don't want to go there. Okay, so I think this is worthy of protection. That's what I'm saying. I encourage you to protect it at every opportunity. There are other elements of the Affordable Care Act that I think are important, and I'm going to go through them pretty quickly, and these are very dense slides, but I'll sort of point to what I think is important. Section 5101 created something called the National Healthcare Workforce Commission. Its job was basically to look at what the needs of the nation are now that we're out of the bubonic plague period and into the chronic illness and chronic pain period. What does that really mean we need in terms of a healthcare workforce? Who are the key players? And I know I shouldn't say we're out of the bubonic plague. We certainly have enough infectious and other kinds of things that we need to pay attention to. And we are into the period of a lot of chronic illness. So they're supposed to look at whether we're training the right kinds of people to take care of the things that are ailing us and whether we've got them distributed around the country evenly in the way that they ought to and stuff. That's their job. And very critically, and the reason I have this part of the law up here is that very critically they offered a new definition of the healthcare, national healthcare workforce, and it included all the usual characters like physicians, optometrists, ophthalmologists, physicians assistants, and then it very importantly added, you see in yellow at the bottom, licensed complementary and alternative medicine providers and integrative healthcare practitioners. Thank you, Bernie Sanders and Barbara Mikulski, for that language in the law. Of course, none of us know what an integrative health practitioner is, but we do know that there are five licensed complementary alternative professions, and we can talk later about who integrative health practitioners are. Okay, that's the good news that was in there. The not-so-good news is that there was no appropriation that came with the National Healthcare Workforce Commission, and the Congress did not see to give them any budget at all. And so the Comptroller General, duly appointed, I mean, took a million, whatever we called them, nominations and sorted through them and duly appointed the 19, I think, people who were going to be on the 19 commissioners. But with no budget, they have no staff, they have no phone budget, they have no travel budget, they haven't met. I hope that's not the end of the story. I think that's just where we are now, and maybe it's just where we were 2 months ago when I checked in with the lead commissioner guy. But we can still work. My view is we can still work with the definition. I think that, you know, a really tight constructionist legal person would say that definition was only supposed to apply to that part of the law, and if that part of the law is not being, you know, enacted fully, then never mind. But I don't really think so. So we've been having, we meaning people at the Integrated Healthcare Policy Consortium, have been having conversations with people in HRSA and people in the Department of Labor about the importance of moving forward with that definition, because if you think it only applied to that part of the law, that's not going to be true next year. Get ready, you know, is sort of our view. Let's move forward with that definition. Okay. Section 2301 offered coverage for freestanding birthing centers, and I think that the important thing here is that this actually is being enacted, and it gives a level of autonomy to, say, certified professional midwives, non-nurse midwives, that they didn't have before. It allows patients more choice about where and how to have their babies. And the main thing that it does is allow for reimbursement both for the facility and for the birth attendant. So it does allow people to set up new centers and not think that they're going to go broke on that. The pace at which this aspect of the law is being implemented varies a good deal from state to state. I mean, I have a friend who lives in Vermont, but she has a center in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire, I think, has been... Oh, Vermont's been moving more quickly on this than New Hampshire. Anyway, the punchline is, it is going to be... There isn't resistance particularly. This is going to be implemented fully. So that is the good news. Section 6301, I think you probably know, and we just spoke about it, created the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. Maybe it wasn't with you that I just spoke about it. I saw Christine Kirch right before I came here. So this is an extra-governmental agency that was created to assist patients, clinicians, payers, policymakers in making informed health decisions by advancing, it says, the quality of evidence about how best to prevent and treat various conditions. The punchline is that you don't get everything in double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized clinical trials. Even as we say, that is always a kind of an iterative process. You always want to look at the next study and the next study. And they're often conflicting. But the other thing was that the way that they get reported out too often is all about the averages. And you know, you get an average about how effective something or other is. I mean, acupuncture, even for arthritis of the knee. And it doesn't tell you that it was really great for some people and totally didn't work for some other people. And it doesn't tell you what the characteristics of those people are. But if you're a patient, you want to know, does that thing work for someone like me? And if you're a doc, you want to know, who is this going to be helpful for in my patient population and who not? You know, so anyway, the punchline is, we needed to be able to do more about comparative effectiveness research, which PCORI now has responsibility for, but we also needed to delve more into what are the appropriate methods that will give us the kind of information we need to make very specific healthcare decisions. That, anyway, is a certain part of what PCORI is responsible for. Okay. So that's what they're doing, and I would say also they were given an enormous amount of money to do it, meaning in 2012, $150 million. As you saw from Adam's presentation and Dr. Burke and Dr. Briggs' presentation, that's already more than NCAM has, or had anyway last year. But beyond 2012, you start to get that baseline plus an additional first $1 per individual assessed on Medicare and private health insurance and so forth. And then later you get $2. So that you have this ultimately moving to about $650 million a year. It is, as we say, a player in the field. And I would say the other good news about PCORI is that I think, my view, and I've sat at a lot of their meetings, and I've given public response on behalf of organizations to most of the things they've issued, and it's hard to do because they're doing a great job. That's what I think. So they've appointed the governing board. They've given us a definition of patient-centered outcomes research. They've set their initial round of research priorities. And very importantly, the methodology committee has now issued a first report that explains to you, I mean, really gives you some range of methods that you can use, clinical, observational, whatever, methods that you can use and help in understanding, based on your question, what will be the best methods to employ. So I recommend that to you. Here's the caveat that I want to say about PCORI and what it can do for us and NCAM and any other particularly governmental research institute, and that is that they can't fund anything for which they haven't received a really qualified proposal. And as Adam made clear, qualified means it's tighter and tighter. But nonetheless, there's a role for almost anybody to play in research, even if you're not the person who's going to, if you're not the scientist, you're not the person who's going to do this, but you're the person with the good idea, you can begin to make relationships with people at the university who are in the right department. We did that years ago. I oversaw the creation of the first research agenda for the field of therapeutic massage, and we invited to the agenda setting process David Eisenberg, Dan Churkin. Dan Churkin, he wasn't doing massage research particularly at that point. This was in the late 90s. But he was doing some of the best back pain research in the world. And so, and now he does do, has done some very important back pain research and other pain research related to, you know, that has involved massage. So I would say that paid off. If nothing else was brilliant about the agenda we created, I would say bringing those people together was good. So that's my way of saying you can, those of you who have clinical practice probably know what should be being looked at. We're talking in this realm about comparative effectiveness research. What are the comparisons that ought to be made? You may have the idea, even though you're not the scientist, and don't hold back from figuring out who. Be a Donna Feely on this. Mention it to everyone until someone picks it up. And then suggest that you would be helpful in creating the protocol, probably, that ought to be compared to whatever the other things is. Anyway, that's my view. Okay, action alert. This is now we're getting near the close. There are three key provisions of the Affordable Care Act that are being determined at the state level. I think there's some appropriateness here. I think there's also some election year punting to the state to make some tough decisions that nobody wants to be held particularly personally responsible for. And these things are coming due now, meaning, okay, so Section 2706 on non-discrimination, the creation of the patient-centered medical homes with their community health teams, and the creation of the essential benefits packages, which will influence every offering made on the state insurance exchanges. This non-discrimination in healthcare, Section 2706, it is implemented in January 1, 2014, this will be the law. That's what I'm saying. And what it says is that every insurer or insurance provider, that it is illegal for an insurer or an insurance provider to discriminate against a whole category of healthcare provider so long as those healthcare providers are operating under their state licensed or state certified scope of practice. And, you know, you can probably give me as many examples of the kinds of discrimination that exist now, not only within private insurance, ERISA plans, but also Medicare and Medicaid and TRICARE. But anyway, this will make that all illegal. It does not say, in fact, it specifically goes on to say, this doesn't mean that you can't pay them differently. You can. Okay, so chiropractors in particular who were arguing that it would say you have to pay on parity, we lost that fight in the creation of the law. And it also says you don't have to take any old provider who's willing to come in. You just have to take some of that category. That can be problematic, meaning that there are things for us to watch in the implementation of this, including whatever it's called, but like that it would be geographically possible for everyone in the state to get to one of those. You know, you can't have one acupuncturist in the northwest corner of a state and say that people now have access. Okay. So that's coming in 2014. Section 3502 established community health teams to support the patient-centered medical homes. And the question is, who's going to be in those community health teams? Who will be covered? And there's sort of two tiers, at least as it is in Vermont. There are two tiers of community health teams, mandated close in and possible farther out. All right. And the last is the essential health benefits, which are being set by states now. All the law says is that it has to, they have to cover these 10 areas, but they don't say what within those areas has to be covered in particular. DHHS punted it over to the Institute of Medicine and asked them for recommendations. I think they actually asked them for sort of a plan, but what they got was some recommendations. All these things are going to are coming together now, and they can have real implications for complementary and integrative health care, I believe. So what I'm saying to you is they've been sent to the state. Every state, you have an insurance commissioner. You might want to get to know that person and let that person know you and know how important and what the potential is that you think integrated health care has. You might want to let that person know that if they are planning essential benefits, but the way that they're writing them doesn't take Section 2706 on non-discrimination into account, that on January 1st of 2014, when they roll out the insurance exchange, they will be already non-compliant on that day with this other aspect of the law. So better for them to seek help in setting essential health benefits in a way and all those plans in a way that would be compliant with the law. I think it's better for them. I know it's better for us because otherwise we have to go to court state by state to, you know, bring them into a compliance. And for you, separate from 2706, look at the essential health benefits as they're being written. Some states are including things. California does include acupuncture still, I think. It was in last week. I don't think it's out yet. Michigan includes chiropractic, not acupuncture. Oregon looked at both, didn't include either. Vermont just dropped dental care out of them. So, you know, states are making interesting decisions. Track it in your own state. Ask yourself whether this is good for your patients, whether it's good for your practice, and whether it matches 2706. The timing is now, and that is it. I'm sorry, I went so long. Thank you.
Rick Harvey's going to discuss this statement. It's regarding the electronic records and how to know how the left hand is talking to the right, whether it be at the state. Similarly, with polypharmacy, or a herbalist who is covered in one state would interact with integrated care. And so that's the nature of the question, not perfectly formed, but what, how do you think about in terms of the advisory council, the role of technology is in communicating? I have a different question.
I don't know the answer to how you, I'm just sitting up here because otherwise I can't see half of you. I don't know the answer to the question about the advisory council, but if you can put your question in writing, I can take it to that body and we can try to move it up the chain. I don't understand what the administration is thinking in general about electronic health records because I don't understand why you would give people a lot of money to do them, but have them all each be able to do whatever brand, whatever thing they wanted so that they're not going to be able to talk to each other. How portable is that? So so I think the whole thing is not thought through well.
And the second question was strategic alliances. When Adam represented Dr. Briggs in regards to things like meditation as fairly robust in terms of utilization, I was thinking about another presentation spirituality and or prayer and or religiosity and somehow interlands of possible strategic alliance with folks that would support complementary alternative integrated techniques,
yeah,
a la religiosity into spirituality into meditation. So not as much sort of in the disguise of religious support for integrated care. And I don't know if anything talked about strategic alliances with other interested groups to get the support of that.
Well, I can tell you a lot of those groups think about strategic alliances because when I was executive director of the Integrated Healthcare Policy Consortium, I got calls from the TM people, from Christian Scientists, people from, you know, a slew of folks who it didn't occur to me to reach out to, but we were able to explore what kinds of, where the common interest is.
Also, those are birds of a common feather. If you have Baptists, if you have conventional, institutional, religious, they are not interested in this world. They're different cultures in some ways. That's a very gross statement. But.
Yeah. No, you.
I had a question for you, Dr. Khan, and also Dr. Adam. For you, I remember reading in one of the slides that the focus is on all kinds of practitioners, including licensed.
Yeah, that was the new definition of the healthcare workforce.
Right. But what about modalities like Ayurveda and homeopathy, which are not currently licensed? So is there any, I don't know, what
yeah.
is the thought process?
So I don't know what anybody else's thought process is, but I can tell you that the Integrated Healthcare Policy Consortium, when we looked at the language of the law, you know, and turned to Bernie Sanders, what do you mean by integrated health? You know, I mean, what they want to be is inclusive. But if you're going to get this into your local hospital or any other place, you have to have some way to credential. And so the homeopaths in particular on our board were saying to us, you know, just put national certification in there. And I thought, well, you can't do that because in Reiki there is a national certification that comes with a weekend and there is certification in Reiki or mastery in Reiki that comes up after 3 years of, you know, incremental study and testing. So So all national certifications are not created equal. So we did end up, and I don't have the language in my mind right now because I resigned from that position a year ago and everything fell out. So, but we do have language, and you can find it on the IHPC.org website. Yeah, IHPC, Integrated Healthcare Policy Consortium. If you go to their website, you'll be able to find the language that we have for how to use national certification. And the punchline is that the body that is offering the certification has to itself have been accredited or recognized by ICE, the Institute for Certification Excellence. And is this the NCQA, their sub-org? Anyway, the language is there about what would be the safeguards around national certification. Because, you know, if you look at the homeopaths, I mean, it's years of study and it's a pretty strenuous exam to get national certification. So there are professions that were, actually the Rolfers were also asking us to take up this question. Because I don't know if that answered you.
Yeah,
and
Kim
doesn't do anything with provider regulation, it's just research. So.
No, I have a separate question too.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so I know this is an effort by NIH and NCA to try and gather evidence of efficacy of these systems. But unfortunately, a lot of these practitioners are not trained in research methods. So does NIH or NCTM, particularly because they are the ones, they are our umbrella organization, do they offer resources to train the practitioners online modules to understand what is research methodology, how to document just case studies, simple case studies? Because the services are being utilized definitely, and you know people are getting benefits, but there's no documentation in a way that can be utilized as evidence.
Right. Two thoughts. One is many institutions, medical schools, for example, UCSF here has something called the TICR program, which is training in clinical research, which is for MDs who are going into clinical research track. But I've done their year of training, and it's a very solid training in clinical research. So there are ways to get that. NCAM does not provide that degree of training, but maybe Prashad can say something about the R25s, just the relationship of NCAM to training of CAM providers.
Yeah, that was a funding mechanism for NCAM, which was there, where they did provide R25 grants to CAM institutions to collaborate with training research-intensive, traditional research-intensive institutions. And where the main intention for that grant is to develop faculty among academic institutions to develop their research. So that mechanism ended, but now they've mentioned that in the recent conference where I attended, that's why it's different to me, because I just heard that. And they said that mechanism ended, but something similar is going to be announced very soon. So if you're part of any academic institution, then it's a faculty within the academic institution.
Kind of excludes Ayurveda.
No, not at all.
No,
not at all. If you are affiliated with even an acupuncture school, you just need to be affiliated with somebody.
Some institutions.
How does a practitioner
who's
moved from India get affiliated
with
another institute?
You go say hello and tell them you're interested in part of it in this world, because there aren't a lot of people who are interested in the clinical and in research. You're a minority. If you say hello, they'll often grab you.
There's a lot of respect for Ayurveda, I think, in general. And I will say that if you look at ACAC, the Academic Consortium for Complementary Alternative Healthcare, I mean, ACAC made a real distinction between working with and on behalf of, you know, they begin with the five licensed CAM professions, but then beyond that, they work with and on behalf of whatever they call them, up-and-coming or traditional world medicines or whatever. If the profession is benchmarking, is interested in becoming licensed within the states. So, you know, with Reiki, I have to say, we have a field where when I speak with the leadership in that field, they're not interested in licensure. And so then I feel like, you know, there's really not a lot we can do for you, because we can't say that if you're not willing to step up and protect the public, you know, be accountable, there's no reason why people should be giving you certain kinds of access, because
yeah, just
but with Ayurveda, the deal is, yeah.
that not to give work to ACAC or NCAM, but the staff would be happy, I'm sure, to talk to you. You could talk to a program officer at NCAM. You could talk to John Weeks or somebody at ACAC. And
about who might be a good connection
they
or
give
a
good ideas,
institutional home. Yeah.
Right. And one last follow-up. The University of New Mexico, I don't know if it's doing it well or not, has an online, I think, a free course on evidence-based medicine. So the knowledge is available regardless of your discipline or field. And you can download PowerPoints.
So if it's Andrew Weil, it's probably Arizona?
Okay.
And if it's New Mexico, it's probably Tijuana Lodog?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, the Flush Darby Foundation has a case report training.
Yeah.
So if practitioners just want to participate in that, the training for putting together a case report is transferable between any discipline. You can go to the Flush Darby Foundation website, mtf.org or massagetherapyfoundation.org, and they will, you'll see it there.
And Marissa, do they
support winners? They have a student case report and professional case report contest every year, so there's some resources in that realm as well.
And do they also still have the research literacy course available
online?
They
have the research literacy courses that they teach to practitioners. They teach them to schools, they teach them to teachers, to instructors. So that's another possible resource. And I know Ayurveda also encompasses some body work, so there might be an angle there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I mean, I have an atheist, but not all the way. I'm from India,
right.
If someone is coming, they're not necessarily trained in
Ticker. Right.
Ticker is a great program, though. TICR. If you look at Boston University, there must be in your area somebody who's offering, because that's a federally funded program in medical schools in the United States.
Thank you so much. Certainly. Yeah. A couple things. One is quality of care. You mentioned that these new systems that are emerging can pay differentially based on quality of care. So it really raises the issue of measuring quality of performance and outcomes in by complementary and alternative medicine, and doing it in a way that's consistent and comparable so that we actually can assess that. And so I'm just making an argument for that, and also how we collect the national data so we can create linkages and get data on that. And so I think that brings me to my next point, which is, you know, this, I think it's a bit of a danger to frame complementary and alternative health practices as being mostly for wellness, because the vast majority of people who have, because you mentioned that, are well-being. That's, I think, an artifact of how the survey is designed and the way they ask the questions, because if you link it to NHIS, nearly all of the people using CAM are disproportionately have multiple chronic conditions, and people tend to speak for functional issues, like they have lots of functional issues. And so I just think it could be really important, especially in linking it up for CORI, which is only focused on conditions, that if we frame CAM as, that's the wellness prevention piece, and this is the truth is we're all dealing with something. And I think that could be really important to put forward, is that, you know, because I noticed that you said that, and then I was wanting to just say the methods really need to be upped. Like, we need to really look carefully at how we're collecting that supplement data and how we're integrating it with other data sets so we can really tell the story.
Right, well, CAMP supplement collects symptom data, and I agree, I didn't mean to say it that way, that CAM use is very much also symptom-related, like back pain, also acute conditions like cold and such. But a lot of the use is preventative, and it's for wellness. If you look at the CAM survey, there'll be a certain percentage, a pretty big chunk, that says I'm using this for my wellness. Wellness could be somebody who's anxious, so it could be symptomatic still, and they describe it as wellness. But there are a lot of people, like people who do yoga, people who do meditation. This is actually one of my soapboxes. They're not. That's not a medical motivation. That's not a disease motivation. That is absolutely a wellness orientation or a feel-good orientation. Yoga, meditation. People do MBSR because they're in a hospital. People meditate because they want to transcend. They want to be happy. It's the minority of people's meditation to lower their blood pressure. Minority. So wellness is a big part of it, but it's both. It's definitely also illness care. And there is a movement these days. At our last meeting, there was a lot of excitement because a number of people on the council are directors of medical centers, medical schools. and the whole notion of electronic medical records, and now starting to put more CAM items into electronic medical records. So the MD is, or the nurse is asking, do you use echinacea? We'll start to standardize this kind of information for these comparative purposes and then looking at outcomes related to those kinds of uses.
Which we can't do for conventional medical care now very much anyway. I was in between you and Dan, David, I remember, right? I think we really need to up the measurement. I guess that's really my main point, is both the quality measurements and how we collect the national data and the conclusions we draw, that there's a need to infuse and upgrade sort of the thinking and strategic data plan thinking so that we have the information to really answer a lot of these questions, because I think it's really compelling.
It's good to see you again, but you should tell Richard Nan and not me, because I'm...
I know. I'm working with him on it.
Good,
but I just
right.
think that wherever we can, and
right.
with the Cori people, they don't talk about health promotion at all, which I did think in the methods report was an issue, because if you look at kids and promoting health development and life course health development, it's for people who are already sick,
right.
and if you're spending a lot of money, that's the other side, you know, is the missed opportunity.
So Cori has a blog that you can go on and influence their process right now. I mean, they're in the middle of prioritizing their research processes and selection processes, and I'm one of the stakeholders that in that process. So I'm going to let you know that they are transparent and trying to get input from all levels.
I know they're really clear that they're going to take a position.
I can't really talk about that piece of it, but they're open to discussion. They're open
to
information, and the more that you get, the more voice that they hear, the bigger the stream is, right? So they just started their blog. They just opened it up, so please consider that.
We want to thank both our speakers, as well as all of you, for being here today. Please feel free to continue these discussions and all of that, not only with yourselves, with the speakers while we're here today. We're in the process of moving down the hall to Salon 13 in Yerba Buena for our last series of presentations related to alternative and complementary health practices, and this will be a special topic. So that'll be starting at 2:30. Yerba Buena, Salon 13, down the hall to right. And thank you.